The speech you are about to hear was given on Sunday, September 4th, 1983, by Robert Matthews at the General Convention of the National Alliance in Arlington, Virginia. A few weeks later, Matthews declared war on the enemies of our race, went underground with a handful of companions he called the Silent Brotherhood, and began fighting. His fight lasted until he was burned to death by a secret police task force a little over a year later, on December 8, 1984, on Whidbey Island, Washington. My first contact with Bob Matthews was in 1980, when he began corresponding with me. After the first few letters, he became a member of the National Alliance, and we corresponded for more than a year before we met. In his letters, he had a number of questions about both the Alliance's message and our recruiting activities, and I answered them as well as I could. We finally met in 1981 when he came to my office for the first time. Bob was a strong, sturdily built, 28-year-old man with short brown hair and an open, friendly face. We talked about a number of things, both theoretical and practical. Bob was interested in ideas as well as in the ways in which we might deal with the immediate problems we were facing. The thing that most impressed me about Bob during our meetings was his intense earnestness. There was none of the make-believe revolutionary about him, none of the historical cultishness or organizational hobbyism or excessive fascination with weapons that I've so often encountered in young men seeking a psychological escape from the unpleasant reality of a Judaized America. Bob was a serious man. He could smile, he could joke, he could laugh, but the overriding impression one got from talking with him was of a man who, like many Americans, was greatly concerned, greatly disturbed about what was being done to our country and our people, but who also, unlike most of those who are concerned, was determined to do something about it, to do whatever he could. To Bob, the situation was quite clear. We were under attack by an extraordinarily malevolent, dangerous, and capable enemy who was determined to destroy us, to destroy our world, to destroy our race, to wipe out every trace of us, just as its tribal God had commanded it in the Old Testament. And our responsibility was to fight this enemy with all our means. There was no question of should we fight, but only of how to fight most effectively. And in particular, there was no question at all of whether or not he personally should become involved in the fight. That required no discussion, no hesitation or soul searching. He took it for granted that it was the inescapable responsibility of every honorable white man to join the fight immediately. Those who failed to do so were cowards or traitors. So we discussed his personal situation, his resources, his training, and his inclinations. I suggested to him that he might best spend his time and energies trying to recruit other people for the Alliance among his neighbors and co-workers near his home in Washington State. And that's what he did. 2 years later, during the summer of 1983, Bob wrote to me about his recent experiences attempting to recruit among farmers, ranchers, and independent truckers in the Pacific Northwest. I asked him if he would prepare a short talk about his recruiting activity and deliver it at the Alliance's General Convention on the Labor Day weekend. He agreed to do so, and the following is his talk.
Thank you, Mike. My brothers, my sisters, from the mist-shrouded, forested valleys and mountains of the Pacific Northwest, I bring you a message of solidarity, a call to action, and a demand for adherence to duty as members of the vanguard of an Aryan resurgence and ultimately total Aryan victory. The signs of awakening are sprouting up across the Northwest, and no more so than amongst the two-fisted farmers and ranchers a class of our people who have been hit especially hard by the filthy, lying Jews and their parasitical usury system. From the beginning of this nation to the present, the yeoman farmer has been a symbol of the Aryan work ethic, a living monument to masculinity. Whenever I think of the first American Revolution, I often remember that stirring poem about Concord and Lexington. By the rude bridge that arched the flood, their flag to April's breeze unfurled. Here the embattled farmers stood and fired the shot heard round the world. Unfortunately, comrades, that poem glorifies a fratricidal conflict. How I dream of a new poem, a poem for today. Out of the valleys, out of the fields, poured the Aryan yeoman horde, their flag to April's breeze unfurled. Thence the Aryan farmers came and removed the Jew forever, forever from this world. Let us not forget, however, that the Levantine vermin are well aware of the dangers that an aroused and angered yeomanry represent to them. The tillers of the soil have always been something of a mystery to the Jews. Cities corrupt. While the soil, the valley, the field, the farm, they revitalize and replenish a weakened and drained mind and body. How the weaselly little city-dwelling Jew fears and suspicions the Aryan farmer. What a contrast in mind and body between the two. I think that deep within the breast of our Aryan yeomanry lies a long dormant seed. The seed of a racial awakening, the seed of resurgence, the seed of anger, and the seed of the will to act. We must radicalize the American yeomanry. We must bring as many of them as possible into our vanguard for victory. The task is not going to be easy. TV satellite dishes are springing up like poisonous mushrooms across the domain of the tillers of the soil. The electronic Jew is slithering into the living rooms of even the most remote farms and ranches. The race-destroying DOMs are everywhere. Allied with the Jews in their attempt to neutralize the Aryan farmer is the ever-present local rural pastor or minister. My personal experience has shown that usually the only organized opposition we will encounter when organizing in a farming or ranching community is from some local pastor. However, the stranglehold that the churches have upon rural America is fast eroding. That stranglehold is fast eroding because the average American farmer and rancher is in extreme financial difficulty. When a man is on the verge of losing his second-generation farm, his livelihood, and in essence his whole life, due mostly to the Jew usury system, he finds little solace in theological baggage from the Levant. I'm particularly encouraged by the success that Texas Klan leader Louis Beam has had in organizing amongst the farmers and independent truckers. He's shown us the way, now we must do it for the Alliance. The potential is there. Working out of a base in northern Idaho, he created an organization called NOFIT, National Organization of Farmers and Independent Truckers. Their slogan is, don't throw a fit, throw a bureaucrat. A Beam, working with actual farmers and truckers from the Northwest, has managed within a few months to reach out and radicalize thousands of these kinsmen. I was talking to a young lady recently who works as a waitress in a large truck stop at Rock Springs, Wyoming. Every time NOFIT puts out a new newsletter, they send her 500 copies. She said they are all gone within a few days, with many of the truckers either joining on the spot or subscribing to the newsletter. The regime in Washington, D.C. is extremely worried about the further radicalization of the American farmer. Fortunately, instead of implementing a program that will genuinely help the farmer, they're responding with massive shows of force and repression, so much the better. 60 miles south of Spokane, Washington, along the Idaho border, is a farming area we refer to as a Palouse. It's one of the richest farming areas in the world. In many places, the Palouse has topsoil that is an incredible 18 feet deep. Along with wonderful soil, the Palouse has a very favorable growing climate. Even so, comrades, many farms in the Palouse are being foreclosed upon. I have met and talked with one of these unfortunate farmers, a kinsman by the name of Ray Smith. Mr. Smith is a large-framed, ruddy-faced man who likes to refer to himself as, quote, a Snake River cowboy and damn proud of it. His father farmed the land he lives upon, and Mr. Smith was recently planning to retire and let his son take over the farm. Mr. Smith's dreams have been shattered, and he's on the verge of losing his 2,000-plus acres, his home, and his son's future livelihood. Mr. Smith, to his credit, took a long, good look at his problem and how he arrived at so starry a state. Now take heart, kinsman. For what did Mr. Smith say when he came to the root cause of his problem? Mr. Smith said, "Jew! Jew! Jew!" Not only did Mr. Smith say Jew, he yelled Jew. His neighbor started yelling Jew. And how did the system react? By sending a plane, a helicopter, a bulldozer, SWAT teams from all over the state of Washington, and 60 very heavily armed deputies to the foreclosure in Mr. Smith's farm. Needless to say, Mr. Smith is now a member of NoFit, and so are his neighbors. Mr. Smith also travels all over the state of Washington, Oregon, and Idaho, speaking out about the Jews and handing out copies of the Protocols of Zion. We need this man in the alliance. Radicalization of the American farm movement is also taking place in the Dakotas and Colorado. Last week, I talked at length to a Colorado-based racialist activist who has extensive personal experience dealing with the Colorado farmers. Several years ago, this gentleman distributed huge amounts of WRAs and other literature to farmers and ranchers around Fort Collins, Colorado. His efforts bore fruit, for soon after his initial literature distribution, he witnessed the birth of the anti-Jewish, pro-white Farmers Liberation Army. The feds are extremely panicked about this outfit. The same gentleman also gave me copies of the Primrose and Cattleman's Gazette, published in Fort Lupton, Colorado. This is an excellent little rural newspaper with a considerable circulation, which is geared towards the needs and interests of the farmer and rancher. What's interesting about this newspaper, in this issue, is an excellent little article on the Protocols of Zion. And this issue here is a full-page advertisement for a very anti-Jewish, pro-white racialist organization. The Jews are coming down hard in this brave little newspaper like chickens on a June bug. It appears that it might eventually fold up, but the seeds have been sown. So, comrades, I have briefly informed you of the potential for our movement, which lies within the farming communities across this nation. We must, it is our duty to, take advantage of the ever-increasing radicalization of the American farmer. The fate of every last white man, woman, and child on this planet lies squarely on the shoulders of us here in this room today. Out of all the white racialist organizations in this nation, the Alliance, and only the Alliance, has the potential to bring us to victory. Through the Alliance lies a salvation for our entire race. We cannot fail. Therefore, let us not only preach, let us live racial economics. Meddling Falls, we are not only eating, breathing, and sleeping, we are growing together as one mind and one body. We have broken the chains of Jewish thought. Meddling Falls, we know not the meaning of the word mine, it is ours. Our race, the totality of our people. 10 hearts, 1 beat. 100 hearts, 1 beat. 10,000 hearts, 1 beat. We are born to fight and to die and to continue the flow. The flow of our people. Onward we will go, onward to the stars, high above the mud of yellow, black, and brown. So kinsmen, duty calls. The future is now. If months from now you have not yet fully committed yourself to the Alliance and the responsibilities thereof, then you have in effect not only betrayed your race, you have betrayed yourself. So stand up like men and drive the enemy into the sea. Stand up like men and swear a sacred oath upon the green graves of our sires that you will reclaim what our forefathers discovered, explored, conquered, settled, built, and died for. Stand up like men and reclaim our soil. Kinsmen, arise. Look towards the stars and proclaim our destiny. In Medellin Falls, we have a saying, defeat never, victory forever. Thank you.
Hey, Bob.
Bob's talk was well received by the Alliance members. People like to hear a call to action, even if they personally have no intention of doing anything except cheering from the sidelines. My own reaction at the time was somewhat cooler, and I tried tactfully to point out to Bob after his speech that his experiences in the Pacific Northwest might have given him a more optimistic view of the situation in America than was justified by the facts. I told him that the people he had talked with during the summer weren't really a cross-section of the American public, and that white people generally weren't yet in a revolutionary mood. In view of subsequent events, perhaps I shouldn't have tried to be tactful, but instead should have stressed the need to maintain a realistic view of our situation and not yield to the urge for premature action. I expressed my regrets in this regard to his widow a few months after his death. She told me that it wouldn't have made any difference. Bob already had decided before he gave his speech what he would do, she said, and there was no holding him back. He was fed up with the slow work of recruiting, which was really much more discouraging work during the 1980s than it is now. And he had made up his mind to take up the gun against the enemy, regardless of the consequences. He already had told her that what he intended to do almost certainly would cost him his life. When most people think about the consequences of Bob's decision, they think only about the negative things, about the facts that he was killed and that a dozen good people were sent to prison. Some of our less radical brethren bemoan the fact that Bob, by using violence against the enemy, provoked repressive measures which made their own work more difficult. Bob succeeded in killing only one Jew, they add, and that Jew, an especially abrasive and obnoxious radio talk show host named Alan Berg, who was machine-gunned in Denver in 1984, would better have been left alive so that he could continue stirring up anti-Jewish feeling among his listeners. Furthermore, the violence gave the patriotic movement a black eye, they complain, and it scared away many potential supporters who want nothing to do with violence or illegality. There is, of course, some truth in these complaints. Many timid people were scared away from the patriotic movement by Bob's activity and the enormous publicity it generated in the controlled media. Perhaps these people's financial support would have been helpful. Perhaps it would have been better not to put the enemy on guard by attacking prematurely. There is, however, a value in what Bob did which goes far beyond such petty consequences. In every revolution, in every great movement for human renewal, symbols are every bit as important as guns and money and manpower. Bob gave us a very important symbol. In the day-to-day work of writing and publishing and advertising and recruiting and organizing, we tend to forget the reality of our situation. We tend to believe that we are in some sort of political or ideological contest, where you deal with your opponents the way the Democrats and the Republicans deal with each other. We go about our work in a civilized way and lead more or less normal lives. At the extreme, we occasionally swap insults in public with our enemies. They call us haters, and we call them un-American or anti-white or sick. The fact is, however, that we are engaged in a fight for racial survival. It is a fight in which either our race or the Jews will be exterminated utterly. And it is a fight which we are losing. We've been losing it for the past 50 years. In every daily newspaper, in every radio or television news broadcast, we're hit in the face with the fact that we're losing. Our noses are rubbed in it every day. We read the statistics about the flood of non-whites coming across our borders, both legally and illegally, and at the same time we listen to the controlled media and the churches uttering shrill accusations of racism against anyone who dares suggest that we already have too much wretched human refuse on our shores, while our government wrings its hands and claims that it is powerless to stem even the illegal portion of the flood. We see the growing hordes of this refuse on the streets of our cities. We know what it is doing to our schools and to the lives of our children. We see a rising tide of degeneracy, of crime, of racial mixing, of drug usage year after year. We see ourselves being dispossessed in our land, with our enemies gloating over each new victory in their growing campaign to disarm us and to silence us while the dispossession continues. Bob Matthews saw all of these things too. And then he stood up and said, "I'm not going to take this anymore. It's not enough for us to say that we believe in a white America. We also must fight for it. It's time for us to begin killing the people who are killing our race." That set a few faint hearts to fluttering among those nominally on our side, who stressed their obedience to the laws our enemies have imposed on us. It should have made them feel ashamed of themselves instead, because Bob was essentially right. He did what was morally right. He may have been a bit premature, and he may have made many tactical errors, but he reminded us that we are not engaged in a debate between gentlemen. Instead, we are engaged in the most desperate war we have ever fought, a war for the survival of our race, and that ultimately we cannot win it except by killing our enemies. And we cannot kill our enemies without taking a chance on being killed ourselves. We needed that reminder. Bob elevated the level of our struggle. He took us from name-calling to bloodletting. He cleared the air for us. In the long run, that will be helpful. In the long run, that's what Bob will be remembered for.